Hey guys, Intern Manager Amy here. New title means new format and responsibility to student now, managing intern duties. So this week's extra credit is a lesson in pop star fanaticism, grief and trauma recognized, and what happens when Eddie realizes where the interns have their office. But before all that, you can tune into brand new episodes each and every week, now on all your favorite streaming platforms and over at our website at filmwasperspodcast.com. We have over 400 episodes for you to choose from, and we can't wait to hear your thoughts in the comment section below. Also, connect with us on our social pages at facebook.com/filmwasapers and on Twitter, Instagram, and Threads at filmwasapy101. Oh, and there's a blue sky at Filmwasapers Podcast. So grab your favorite ballpoint pen and a fresh bag of popcorn as we press play on our latest selection from The Intern Files.
Well, we are back with another Intern Files, and this time I suckered Eddie into the closet slash my office that I'm allowed as managing intern, intern manager Amy.
This used
Amy.
To be where we kept all of like the old props in the studio.
I know, you wouldn't be
literally like there's cobwebs and everything in the corners.
No, that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Are those your friends? I'm sorry.
Yes, they keep all the mosquitoes.
Fellow off potential recruits that you're going to try to bring in for other junior from Lost Verse. Yeah, we are here with an intern files, I guess. This is what happens when I'm not working on the mic and we give content to our interns and let them run away with
hey,
it. So
managing intern manager.
You know, you keep playing fast and loose with that title. I don't know how
it's
much
not
longer
fast,
it's going to.
It's just a little loose.
It's very loose because it's like, what? Because when was the last time we actually had an intern on the show? Well, I know that we have actually, and we were just mentioning it a little bit ago before we went on the air. Mm-hmm. Intern Sarah is really working hard and kind of running up that ladder. Like she's now on full-time duty of editing.
I know.
She's also one of our top researchers for certain things. Mm-hmm. I mean, the girl's got a knack for reaching that brass ring. You might want to be worried a little bit. Just saying.
I'm free to leave at any time.
You're free to leave, but you know, I mean, there's a couch in here. Yeah, I don't know how you fit it in here, but there's a couch in here.
There was a lot of work and a lot of taking it apart and putting it back together. Don't look at the underside. It'll be great.
No, I barely was able to squeeze into this room this couch.
But you fit.
You know, half of this couch is sawed in half. So
we don't talk about
So why
that.
Am I here? What is the reason for why
you're here for
why you've brought me out of my luxurious studio with all my ample space. I'm literally hitting a shelf with my elbow.
Hey, be careful. It'll fall.
Oh, there's drinks. Oh, it's empty. Never mind.
No, that was not my fault. So we're here because, well, I wanted to talk about a movie that I got the opportunity to see and so did you.
Yeah.
But we don't have space right now on the main show to talk about it. And I wanted to get some conversational feedback on A24's Mother Mary.
Yeah. That was a very unique movie that we saw. I don't know whose logic it was to not promote it as much as it should have been, but it was definitely on the list because it seemed intriguing enough. Unfortunately, just due to our scheduling and everything else that we had in terms of what's on the horizon, it just didn't pan out. And so we're literally, this is after hours, after Spencer and I have done all the great and wonderful things that we do for this studio and for this show. And then Amy pulls me into this, you know, broom closet of his office.
It's a nice closet. I want to talk about this movie.
It's a nice horse blanket.
Hey! That's mean.
Okay, talking about Mother Mary.
Okay, Mother Mary. It is written and directed by David Lowery of The Green Knight fame.
Yay.
And it starts... You said you liked that.
Is there no like structure on this show?
No, it's conversational
again,
for the most part.
Much like your title, this show is fast and loose.
Hey.
Just saying.
Hey. So it stars Anne Hathaway, Michaela Cole, Hunter Schafer, Athena Frizzle, Kai Gerber, Jessica Brown.
If she's not married, does she become Miss Frizzle?
Ooh, that'd be awesome. Isara Barbe Brown, Alba Baptista, Sion Clifford, and FKA Twigs, who I really like. And yeah, so a kind of a brief back. I, I don't want to give it official synopsis goodness because...
Hey, this is your little, you know, little corner of the world. However you do you, you do you.
Do you know what? I'm going to try to unofficially official synopsis goodness this because it should have been on the main show.
So,
do you want to read it? I could read it. I got it. Okay. So long buried wounds rise to the surface.
I was half expecting like some kind of like intensity and like some kind of emotion. But no, you're like, longer than
wow, this is just rainy day.
I've been playing Donkey Kong Bonanza. Every single person in there talks like that. So I'm just,
That's true.
That's literally what they don't have voices, like regular voices. I don't know how that's rude. Oh, is talking about in reference to you or you?
Yes.
Oh, nah, it's not that rude.
Okay. Well, long buried wounds rise to the surface when iconic pop star Mother Mary reunites with her estranged best friend and former costume designer Sam Ansel on the eve of her comeback performance.
Man, you could have done so much more than that.
You didn't ask for a dramatic reading.
I did the second time around. I literally said I thought this was going to be dramatic. Come on. Have you not heard of the movie guy voice? He literally does the intro to our main show.
I can't in a world this. Yeah, I you don't can. You have just the did. Range
you just
for
started
it.
And you're like, in a world, like whatever.
That's not me.
Okay. All right. So this movie.
Yes. So Mother Mary, we both got a chance to see it. I really... It's going to be in a weird kind of spot because I liked it. And then there was a lot of mixed themes, mixed emotions, really great performance. And you and I had got the chance to see it and it was late. And there was just a lot of like, not on the fence-ness for you. No,
it's not so much on the fence-ness. It's more so of trying to understand what the director's really trying to say, much like any movie. Like you take a look at every movie that is out there. Someone will, what is that? What is that saying? Someone will look at the universe and see, or someone will, I don't know. Either way, like you can take two very unique perspectives on it. Much like any movie you look at, anybody can gather whatever they want. Someone can watch Kung Fu Panda and watch, you know, and gather like the answers to the universe, and then someone else will watch Interstellar and think, oh, pretty stars. Like it's all in the eye of the beholder. And this is one of those ones. I think that's like the magic of what movies are, in that we pride ourselves to be the I Ching, if you will, of what the movie should be, when in actuality, the truest nature of like what any movie critic should understand is that everybody's going to get whatever they want. Whether or not if it's intended or not intended, people will walk into a movie and experience, you know, Mecca if they wanted to after watching the Lego movie and be content with it, you know, but it's neither here nor there. So for myself, when it comes to this movie, yeah, I had a couple different perspectives because it doesn't just play as a single narrative type of movie where it's like, oh, this is what it's about. Because it interjects way too much in different elements. And if you take a look at David Lowery's previous works, such as The Green Knight, there was a ton of stuff that was in that movie that made it more than just your typical Green Knight tale. Mm-hmm. Like, there was elements of it that had very unique, you know, implications as far as his storytelling, what the story is really conveying, who the Green Knight ultimately is at the end of the story, what is his name? Starts with a G. Sir Gawain. Mm-hmm. You know, what he truly represents, what certain elements of the story represent, what does the kiss represent? Like, there are so many different things that are like, okay, I get the story and I understand what the beats are and I understand what the original tale was trying to say. But in that same instance, David Lowery is adding more to the story to create a bigger takeaway. And again, that doesn't just always mean that like, oh, it's so uppity that, you know, no one's going to truly understand. Sometimes it's just simply wanting to add an extra part of themselves in the story.
Yeah.
So I think going back to this film he did, I think that was the case here.
So with this film, I almost want to go like, how did it make you feel?
Okay, doctor. I know I'm sitting on this sawed off couch over here, but either way,
comfy.
Until my feet hit the floor, hit the wall on the other side of the thing. The fact is that this movie's unique enough to where it has interest and it has engagement. I don't know though if it was strong enough to lean in any particular direction that I'm like, oh yeah, it was absolutely this. And nor like it also didn't give me enough interest on one side or the other to find favor. Not so much to lean, but to find favor, like, oh, that's what I would absolutely want it to be. You know, so the nature of this movie is ultimately you have two characters, one who's a famed pop star, aging famed pop star. Mm-hmm. The other one is a seamstress / dressmaker who used to be the stylist for this pop star when they were in her younger part of her career.
And she's a very well known, like,
yes,
designer.
Yes. She's very much the Lady Gaga of this current time frame, you know. And at a point in time, they deviated ways. It created a large enough rift ultimately with certain emotions caught in the middle of it, created enough of a rift where one had a very large emotional response to it. The other one had a very physical
response
to it, mm-hmm. but both of them shared this symbiotic, otherworldly, I guess, relationship in that nature, like a moment bond, almost like a trauma bond that created something that tied them still together.
True.
And so this is at this point in time in the movie, the pop star comes back to see the dressmaker, pleads for a last dress to be made. A slew of conversations occur and the effort and hopeful progress to resolving whatever is going on between them is caught in the middle of a dress needing to be made for a possible final performance.
Yeah.
In all that said, there's two. So these are the two frames of thought that I had when it came to watching this movie.
Only two.
Wow. Well, two. I said two main.
Now you put in the main. Okay.
There's a few other like rabbit trails and deviations. But the first train of thought is this movie is ultimately chronicling what happens when two people who are so dependent upon each other in terms of their relationship, in terms of like needs and desires and the hope for companionship in any sense of the word, mm-hmm. is suddenly broken into, and the pain and the grief that is between them leads to a traumatic moment, and that trauma bonding can ultimately manifest itself in a physical or even in a spiritual way. And this movie chronicles that whole journey of understanding how trauma not only unites us all in certain aspects, but it's also one of the things that beats us all down. And until we recognize it and we work through it, it will always be the one thing that truly never allows us to be completely whole. Mm-hmm. And we see that very easily and paralleled in the story here.
Second one.
That is the first one. The second one is that pop stars are dumb as rocks, and that the fact that they would believe that the thought is that David Lowery is putting on display potentially the most satirical and lambastic way of how pop stars sometimes see themselves as godlike entities who look down upon these people almost like deities and see them as, oh, this is all the burdens I bear. Watch me, mother, as I lay my hands upon the cross and die for your sins, kind of thing. And ultimately,
and you're not just talking figuratively, because there's a lot of religious imagery.
I mean, her name is Mother Mary,
and she wears a halo,
and she
has an entire. There's, if we wanted to talk about literal imagery, there are moments where she is silhouetted by the heavenly divine light with the golden halo and the white dress and the sash and the heart. Like, she gets pretty in,
Yeah, and it's...
Costuming was brilliant. Oh, my gosh. I mean,
yeah, the costuming was brilliant. But still, like, the recognition of, like, oh, my gosh, okay, everything that she is saying, if I take myself out of that first mentality, that first thought process, mm-hmm. everything that she's saying, everything that she's complaining about, everything that's happening, it's a very first world problem mentality. It is absolutely something that nobody else is going to be dealing with or worried about or having struggled with. And the fact is that the character of Sam...
Ansel, which is the stylist.
Which her name is Sam in the... Mm-hmm. Like, that character is pretty much us from the common folk watching those types of people have this whole just meltdown and crash out. It's like the Britney Spears moment for every single pop star. And it's unfortunate, as a side note, that we now use Britney Spears as a moment of pure crash out for any pop star. I mean,
that it is tokened the Britney Spears moment.
The Britney Spears moment. And, you know, mind you, I haven't really heard much about what's been going on with her, but again,
I've heard things, but this things
again, as another side note, she really got the raw end of the deal during a time frame when the recognition of the importance of female pop stars and what they were doing for society as a time, not as like politically or, you know, changing, you know, the perspective on, you know, global warming or whatever, but like just as fixed points for young girls trying to be something other than just, you know, moms and housewives and things mm-hmm. like that. It just, with everything she's faced and all the scrutiny and everything, just for being a woman in the industry, mm-hmm. just for literally having a pair of lumps on her chest and no pee pee between her legs, she's mm-hmm. ultimately X, Y, and Z. And yeah, it makes you wonder, like, again, first world problems. Going back to this movie, how the perspective of certain pop stars tend to believe that their world is just much more important and valuable than others.
Well, and I think that's something that can be kind of questioned in your first view of this film. I more wholeheartedly agree with versus your second.
Yeah, that's typical.
Yeah, I know.
Amy wishes the whole world was sunshine and rainbows.
Exactly, because, you know, the glass.
And I see it for the way it is.
Nah, you just like, oh, that glass could use more water. And I'm like, the glass is half full.
Well, the world's thirsty and you might as well make it full.
Mm-hmm. So in regards to looking at like this being a first world pop star problem, I really was kind of drawn into the fact that the acting in this, especially from Anne Hathaway, was very much a... It felt almost like coming back to a broken relationship, like a true broken relationship, and begging to have a, like, please tell me I'm not crazy kind of thing to like your anchor. And it was just, I didn't see it as just her being a pop star and she believes she's the center of all the universe and everything here and everything there and mm-hmm. nobody can touch me and I am, you know, I am, surprise. Like, the way Anne Hathaway busts in the first time we see her in the same space with I almost said Michela, which is wrong. I think it's Michaela. It's spelled like Michaela. I suck at names pretty aggressively.
I wasn't going to say anything, but I mean, that was...
Yeah, I know.
Bad.
Thank you. But the first time we see Mother Mary come into a scene with Sam, she's drenched head to toe. She looks like a wet, dead rat. And she is just north of Fontaine from Les Mis when she was in the Les Mis musical. You made a weird face.
Because... Where are you going with this?
So basically, when we see her in those moments, she's so intensely like, just, she looks flighty, she looks panicky, she's trying to connect, she doesn't know what to do, she seems at her wit's end. You can't really assess the full state of her, where you're wondering in balance with Sam's character, who is like, why are you here? I didn't ask you to come in, you barged in. It's this... It's a, which, I'm drowning.
Which more implicates my logic for the second one, in that we don't invite these people into our ears or into our hearts. We get inundated with it and just have to come to grips with that, the fact that they're just everywhere. They're around us. Again, it's the more and more I look and really kind of dive into that logic, the more and more it becomes more prevalent as the intended sentiment. But again, I am more of the realist than you are. So you hope and pray, oh, they hold hands and run off into great beyond at the end of all that.
The end of this gave more clarity to the separation that there was and the resolution that they came to versus them just being sunshine and rainbows. Like, I didn't expect, oh, happy ending. Everybody's together.
So like, then, okay, let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. As someone who apparently listens to this type of music.
Yes, my dirty secret. Not really dirty, because it's just my secret. I like pop music a lot. Keep going.
Okay. Someone who listens to this type of music, has this type of story ever happened before in any particular pop star?
To any particular pop star?
I mean, yeah, because it seems like this, to take the understanding of this particular role and whatnot, I'm pretty sure Anne Hathaway had to do some research.
Yeah. So she had done a couple of years of vocal training, dance training, because she's like, I can't dance. But really when it comes, she watched a lot of the Beyonce Homecoming concert. There was a Madonna concert doc that was out for a bit. And then there's Taylor Swift, which is actually who David Lowery has kind of stated his concept for writing all of this, because he wrote and directed it, was based on like, what would Taylor Swift be like in like 10 to 15 years from where she is now. And when it comes to the question of, has there been the crash out, the Britney crash out moment. You've had a lot of female pop stars who have had to reinvent themselves, not always with a traumatic incident that made it happen. But there are lots of, I mean, Madonna's reinvented herself. Miley Cyrus has reinvented herself. Taylor Swift, exactly. It reinvented herself to become more pop than country. And this story isn't, I can't honestly say it's a tale as old as time, but there's already instances in it in our zeitgeist where we see it happening enough that it's not too terribly unfamiliar. Like, it's the somebody goes quiet, there's the hush, they disappear temporarily and suddenly they're back and they're bigger than ever. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't always take a traumatic event for that person or that pop star, that celebrity, to decide to transform. Sometimes it's just a rebranding. I think that was one of the more interesting ones, if we're talking about Taylor Swift, which I need to preface, I am not a Swiftie. I listened to her when she was country Taylor Swift, and I know a couple of her now songs, but I have not participated in any of her tours or seen her music, her concert, TV, yada, yada. I do know Swifties. I've asked questions about that to better understand like kind of that dynamic of the relationship, because the Swifties are not just a brand or a fan club. They see themselves as a community, as a movement, as a like entity. Mm-hmm. And as much as they are a fandom, it is this, the question, one of the questions I brought up was like the parasocial relationship between celebrities, especially pop stars, and their fans. And one of the biggest ones and one of the easiest ones that I could recognize right now was the Swifties, and how Mother Mary in this movie, she's got this otherworldly air, and nobody could see my air quotes with this otherworldly.
Yeah, I'm like, why are you putting it's
the hands? I think it's the hands. You can see the hands. They're over here.
Okay.
So she carries this. The way that it's laid out is that not only is she the biggest thing, she's been the biggest thing. Like, she carries this need that the only thing that she can do is sing sad songs when she's supposed to be happy, or sing happy songs when she's sad, to help inspire and lead people, which Sam calls out as like, oh yeah, that's BS. And it seems to weigh so
again, still furthering my point.
But that's something that I wanted to kind of understand, was like with parasocial relationship between the God-esque, air quotes, symbolism that is someone like a la Taylor Swift and Swifties, like what inspires people to even have that connection? How do you get there? And then why does it turn into something that ultimately breaks whoever the celebrity is? Because there's no way that this ever ends up like nobody.
I mean, that's an easy answer. I mean, to be honest, it's,
is it?
Yeah, it is. Because when you get to, there is a level of, and this is, I'm not saying this about the Taylor Swift type people. I'm not even saying this about Taylor Swift herself. So you Swifties don't come at me, but like there's a certain sense of manipulation that you have to be able to have people see you the way you feel they want to see you, and recognizing that and filling a role is as much a part of being a manipulator as anything. And when you get to a certain point to where, I mean, anybody can walk up to anybody and be as fake as possible. Hey, how's it going? Yeah. Uh-huh. And yeah. Oh, definitely. And whatever, whatnot. Like there's a difference between the people who are super like genuine and the people who know how to feign being genuine for the sake of, so you're going to buy a ticket, right? Or you're going to come see the show, right? And I'm not saying that that's what Taylor Swift is about, but what I'm saying is there's a level of that kind of rubberiness that someone has to have at a certain point in people's careers. Like obviously that rubberiness has to go away and you just need to work to maintain the relationships of the fandom that is dwindling slowly as you continue to, you know, disappear into nothingness, you know, not to say that that's the case for anybody right now. That still does that. Like Matthew Lillard is a great example of a genuine human. Matthew Lillard knows his boundaries. He recognizes his mental health. He knows where he is at right now in his career. And he's willing to give that time to all of his fans. I don't know if it's maybe Big Brother listening, or because I haven't really even talked about him lately, but he's been popping up a lot on my feed. Mm-hmm. There was a couple of thread posts that I saw the other day. There was one I saw where this guy was like at Matthew Lillard on Threads. He goes, I don't know if you remember me, but a few years back,
yeah, I had that one.
Yeah, he's like, you know, I had came to you and, you know, we were, I was whatever. I had just lost my house or all these things. I was like,
he was going into rehab.
He was going into rehab and Matthew Lillard just
one day at a time, one step at a time.
Yeah. And he responded like, I've been sober 18 months now and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and Matthew Lillard even responded and was like, you know, hey man, I appreciate the shout out, but you're the real hero here. You know, congrats and keep it up.
Yeah. And he said it again, one day at a time, one step at a time.
Yeah. And so like people like Matthew Lillard, that's a legit, genuine person. Pop stars, I don't like it's, there's so much within that industry. There's so much within that culture that it's just difficult to really see if there's anybody still genuine left. Unless you are so big that nobody can touch you. And then at that point, you're just like, you know, screw it. I'm just going to be however I want to be. Like you have to play the game. You have to work within the confines of what the studio expects of you and perform when they want you to perform and do whatever. And then out of all that, you know, you got to do whatever you want to do. Like it, there's a level of like ruthlessness and shrewdness that you would just have to have. And I think part of the shtick is maintaining that, you know, hey, hi, how's it going? Mentality.
But I also think that comes into question. And this is where you and I not so much differ, but we reckon we've already established you're the realist, I'm the optimist. And
yep, very true.
But it's also for every, and again, because we don't know pop stars personally, we can't speak to the content of their character. We are only being fed whatever marketing and branding does dictate.
I can speak towards the knowing of like Christian pop stars and understanding that industry, because I've been a part of that industry for many years. And I can tell you for certain that there is a sense of just this thin veil that pop stars wear, so that way they can seem and appear as genuine as possible, just enough to get people to still think, oh, they're good people, I'll watch them next time they come through. Mm. I'll buy the next ticket. There's an absolute big star within the Christian pop music world, and he is known far and wide for being like, to the fans, he's this great whatever, he is the most whatever, everybody loves him. He does all these tours on boats, he does all these different music festivals, he gets paid, obviously, but everybody thinks he's just the most genuine person in the world. And I have met this person several times, and this guy is a class A jerk. He couldn't care less if his fans loved him or hated him, but because he knows that he needs them to buy tickets, he will hope that they see him as a plausible option for their next entertainment option. Mm. I mean, I have seen him in interviews. I have seen him get upset at people for no reason. Like he absolutely does not consider his fandom as important people. Mm. And that is in the Christian world. This is somebody who should have the hope of Jesus and the Christ-like mentality. And yet he looks at every single person, doesn't see a name. He sees a dollar sign. You know, does he put on a good show? Sometimes he uses auto-tune. I don't know if most of his fans know this, but he uses auto-tune. Like, whatever. But ever since I found that out, like, I think I burnt every single one of his CDs. I got rid of him because it was like, I recall when I was younger, when I had listened to him, I thought he was a good guy. I thought he was a great singer. And then I got older and then I met him and I'm like, okay, he seems genuine enough. And then I really met him and I'm like, nope. And that's just the nature of like pop music. That's the nature of the music industry as a whole. People are made to be, are told to be a certain sort of way so that people will like them on the exterior. Mm. That's it. They don't have to, you know, they don't have to sit with you. They don't have to listen to your life story. They don't have to hear all the things that why their music touched your life. Because honestly, they could care less. Truth be told, they probably don't remember a single story of someone who went up to them and said, when I heard this song, it changed my life. Like, oh, that's so sweet. Thank you. And then they walk on and like, what did she say? And it's that simple. That's the way the industry is. In this particular case, coming back to the movie, I feel like that's kind of the recognition of like, you see the issues that happen. You see the situations that are kind of remembered. You see all the instances of like hardships and whatever, but they're all through the lens of opulence. They're all through the lens of like, they get to do this every night. They get to perform and do these things every night. Oh, yes, it's a slog. And she has to push herself. But at the end of the night, she gets to go home to this, or she gets to go and lay in this massive bed in the middle of this huge hotel and get food that's just catered to her hotel room. But all of her fans probably spent a good amount of money just to get tickets to that place. And they're probably still stuck in traffic trying to get home because they have to get home because they have to go to work the next morning.
Well, see, and then I think that becomes the question where this movie intersects with that mentality is when Mother Mary finally breaks down and realizes the outer shell is no longer the person she started out to be and wanting to get back to that, where she goes back to the beginning. I said, you know,
yeah.
And the not only the search, but the sorrow and the grief of things sacrificed to get to that Madonna, Lady Gaga, Taylor Swift, Beyonce level of
they
fame.
They all complain
in this
that
film.
they have to do the work, but they don't complain when they get the paycheck. So, I mean, I again, this is from a very pragmatic and realistic point of view. Based off of a movie, mind you. So
this
again,
is all based off of a
nobody
movie.
Started like, oh, he's saying things about Taylor Swift and he's talking about my Christian music artist. Oh. No, this is literally all from the perspective of like what this movie is trying to present. Hmm. And in all honesty, like you get to the point where in this movie, a situation occurs where there is a literal cut on someone's chest. And someone has to insert a finger in touch into pretty much the area of their heart. The thing that changes the pop star in this movie happens to be a true connection with what would have been a real fan.
Now,
what does that sound like? Does that not sound like my...
But the question is, too, because of the way that this is inferred, is that they were more than just a fan. She had been...
To who, though? Because a lot of this, you again,
and that's it. It's also that's the case of this because there's so much space for interpretation.
Who's the only person who's truly hurt in this entire thing? It is Sam. It is the stylist. Anne Hathaway's character isn't that hurt because she shows up on her doorstep demanding a dress to be made in less than 3 days from a world-renowned dressmaker,
which is also like
who has the cojones. To walk in, who's walking up into any of these designer, like who's a big designer in the world right now?
Just naming.
I don't know. Does it look like I wear fashion? I work here. Like,
say the
head designer at Ralph Lauren. Someone just walks into there and be like, make me a suit. I need it by tomorrow. And they're like, security, like ultimately. The fact that this woman walks right up into this woman's house shows that there was no pain there. There was no hurt. There was no, it was just based out of a need she had. And much like every pop star who operates in that first world mentality, it is them first, you last.
Well, then it's also that there's something more than just a casual friendship that was going on. Or that had went on for some time for the fact that she just like, she knows exactly where Sam is. She knows where Sam was sleeping. Like there's this whole thing that there is this, the way that it is acted, which mind you, it is literally like what, maybe a one room / two room drama. The space itself doesn't change. Like it changes in flashbacks, but you see that they're still in this, essentially it's a barn, like a barn warehouse.
It's almost like a theater stage setup.
Yeah.
In how they do their flashbacks and so forth.
Yeah. Except for when they cut to like the big concert arena tour bit part.
No, that was still, she opens the doors to the barn to go to that.
Okay.
It's all still so in the still, same sound stage.
In the barn-ish area. But so there's like, The way that this is not only acted but staged has this tension and anger of breakup, and it's not just like you were my friend. It has it's
what you're trying to imply is that there was something more intimate going on than just being friends.
Yeah, which I found.
But again, that's still in the mindset that it's only coming from one side. It's the only person again who is truly hurt the most out of all this. And then when when the threat of not getting a dress comes about, then Anne Hathaway's character begins to turn on the emotions. It isn't until Sam, every single instance is led by Sam as a means to, this is what happened. And then the pop star says, well, when that happened, this happened to me.
Well, and also you had the part where Mother Mary walks in and is like, I'm sorry. And Sam's like, no, say it again. And she makes her keep saying it. And then she goes, no, don't say it now. Say it when I least expect it. Surprise me. Surprise me with your sincerity and it's something along the lines of your sincerity and being genuine. And it's like this, it rings of the, I still like you. I want you around, but really you've messed everything up and now
or
I'm trapped.
Or it's a nature of indifference due to the fact that you've created separation from this one thing because it no longer serves you. Such as people who move on from being a Swiftie, people who move on from being a fan of Beyonce, people who move on from being a fan of Lady Gaga, people who move on from being a fan of Justin Timberlake. This is going to ruin the tour. like all these people who move past that. And then in those pop stars' older age, they start trying to pander to that particular era of audience. And it's like, nope.
Hi, Madonna. We see you.
I mean, but it's like, again, it's you move past it and it no longer serves you. So you're like, yeah, make me want to listen to you again. Why should I? What is the reason? I'm busy right now. I'm talking to a telemarketer. I don't have time to listen to your music. Why should I? There's a running thread that happens in this whole entire movie where constantly Sam tells Mother Mary, I don't want to break my streak of not listening to your music.
Yeah.
Who says things like that? Fans who are disgruntled and no longer listen to a certain pop star.
Which also brings about a rather interesting sequence that I kind of wanted to get your opinion on, which was the new song that this dress is supposed to be made for, which is called Spooky Nation or Spooky Action. Sorry.
Spooky Action.
Spooky Action, which the Mother Mary or Sam says, well, show me the choreography. I need to see what you're going to dance so that the dress fits you correctly. And Anne Hathaway is like, okay, do you have a speaker or something? And Sam's like, no. And that's where the, I don't want to break your streak. But Anne Hathaway goes into this almost possessed dance, which starts out very pop, like military. I'm surrounded by dancers. And she does it totally without sound. And you are hearing her footsteps, her breathing, you're hearing.
Because like, that wasn't all the dance.
Yeah. And that was the thing that I was like, it seemed like it started like initially, like there were the bones of it, with like the.
Because tapping. Even those steps were the steps that they had done at the beginning of the movie when they were doing the dance sequence on the stage. And then when she transitions into the more outlandish moves, all she's doing is reiterating the possessed woman that was in that hotel room. All the moves that she was doing. There's no, that
is FKA Twigs. So,
and yeah, then on top of all that, during the course of it, Sam's like, okay, I've seen enough. And what does Mother Mary say? No, I need to finish this as if I need to do the whole performance because you paid to see the whole thing. And even then, if you look at the dance choreography, there's no way that that dance choreography would work because there's tables and she uses the tables as part of the movements. There's not going to be any tables on that stage.
We don't know.
There wasn't. We saw the last.
We saw the final stage.
We saw the final stage, and there was none of that. And she used the room itself as a means as part of the dance, which is why it's indicative that it wasn't a part of the dance, which means it was just to serve to get Sam back and hooked.
So, if my understanding at this moment is. Do you see this film as essentially it's just a manipulator coming back for another serving? Like coming back to a source and everybody else forsaken?
That's the nature of every single, to an extent. I mean, we're looking at, again, the mentality of like what pop stars do, how pop stars are, the life cycle, if you want to call it, of a pop star, the life of a pop, But at the crux of it all, every single fixation is an addiction. Every single, manifestation of the hopes and dreams that we will one day, be in the eminence of a certain individual who wrote the number one hit 2 months ago. Like that's always part of that mentality. Either way you look at it, like it is essentially every single one of those relationships, whether if it's a Swiftie, whether if it's a fan of Beyonce, whether if it's a fan of, Disturbed, whether if you're a fan of, St. Paul and the Broken Bones, whether you're a fan of, the Yankees or a fan of, the Lakers, or you're a fan of, the Red Wings, if you're a fanatic of those particular fandoms, then it is a drug. It is an addiction. It is recognizing who is the manipulator and who is the manipulatee. Like, and what do people do for that next hit? And by hit, I mean the next opportunity to engage or to be in the atmosphere or community of that particular thing. And so, yeah, I mean, at the very, 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 very crux of it, that is ultimately what it is, a manipulator wanting to see if they can manipulate one last time so that they can get what they need.
We'll return after these messages.
Well, it's very interesting that you brought or you used the word community when you're talking about fanatics. And I actually had kind of talked to a Swiftie because I was curious about like,
what Swifties do you know? You don't know Swifties.
I know a handful of Swifties. There are no and Swifties. One of the Swifties that I know is not a Swiftie you would expect, but they also have a, like, I asked the question, like, what drew you not only to the music, what made you a Swiftie? Like, why do you identify as a Swiftie? And the answer was fairly like interesting because he had mentioned that initially his wife had brought him, like, he had been hearing her music. It kind of, he wasn't wholly turned off by it. But he started listening to some of her music and was like, okay. And then going to one of the concerts, he had this entire sense of community, of belonging, of, you know, the becoming part of something more. And that experience is what made him, like, what made him identify not only as a Swiftie, but how he wanted to participate.
I mean, if I walk into a public bathroom and there's 12 guys pooping at the same time, I'm not going to say, guys, we're doing it. It's just a situation that happens, and it just happened to be happenstance.
Just a situation I mean, that happened.
I get it. You can find community in just about any fandom that's out there. You could walk into an arena of, you know, certain sports fans, and the moment you step in, like, it is like coming into a huge house party. You know, I get it, but I don't get it at the same time, just because there is a sense of like religious fanaticism when it comes to certain types of fandoms like these. And it requires a sense of, I guess, ownership of what you are in order for you to be a fan of that. And I don't think I can commit that heavily. I'm ADHD. I can't even commit to just doing the right thing every day.
Well, and the reason that you brought up fanaticism as well was because, like,
the reason I brought it up, or the
reason? You originally did bring it up, and we're talking about community and like that experience. Mind you, I'm not going to walk in and be like, if I was in a club and there was going to the bathroom and there are 12 girls, we'd definitely hype ourselves up and it would work. But I think it's that, hey, it works. Okay.
Okay, sure, it works. Calling a Swiftie a bathroom buddy. Go ahead.
The thing is, wow, that's just wow. It becomes
I hope that you let your friend know next time you see them. Like, hey, I heard that your Swifties are just bathroom buddies.
No. There's a lot more that he had said about like his connection, his ability to understand that she's over there and he can disconnect at any time because really it was the experience.
Honestly.
I mean that's a question you'll have to take up with him. But he brought up
every drug addict or every smoker that I've known. It's like, I could quit anytime I want. It's all good.
But and he also brought up that the thing that really kind of made him a Swiftie was the experience, was the excitement, was the community, and how one of the social media pages I have, I don't know where it is, but I have something pinned and it said humans need community. And it's this concept that I have strongly and fervently believed that everybody needs to belong somewhere, because when you do, not only do you feel more like connected to who you are, but you can become either a better or a worse version of who you have always been. And with this movie, we see.
But is that a community, or is that, I mean, for all intents and purposes, a cult? Like,
that is the best question, because wouldn't you say the same thing about religion?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. And so that's what's the difference?
What are you trying
exactly.
to say?
Exactly. No, but that is the question. Where does that line devolve from being a community where you're supporting and caring to one another, when it becomes to the level of a cult, a manipulation? It becomes That's the same thing that you also see in these types of environments, in the concerts, in the praise of their almighty worship ceremonies at concerts for Taylor Swift, for Beyonce, where it becomes this, you know, transcendent, intimate, religious experience for these people. And we're looking at it and we're all like, okay, y'all are crazy. And some of it I totally agree with. And then when you go to church on Sunday, you find out that they're, and some of the, a lot of the mega churches, they're doing the same lighting thing. They're doing, they have like the however many piece like on the stage. And it's this, you have to have the feeling like to experience the spirit moving you in church, and that's okay.
So yeah, we I get it. I mean, we both come from a background that's heavily influenced by religion. I get that part. But again, you're not making my argument any less, you know, impactful and meaningful, in that quite literally, this is just another manipulator trying to get another person back into their addiction.
No, and that, I think that was kind of the question that I wanted.
Because I think the ending speaks for itself. Because at the end of the movie, you have this huge, like, crescendo of a situation that occurs, and you're like, oh, okay, they've connected again. Everything's good. Everything's great. Everything's whatever. And then at the end, you just see her by herself. Like, you see the dressmaker with her assistant, and they're envisioning what's supposed to be happening, but the pop star is probably doing whatever she's doing. They don't say for certain that what is happening in the film is exactly what she is doing. Mm-hmm. She could have essentially said all those things. What you realize is she could have essentially said all those things to Sam just to have her make a dress that people wait months, if not years, for a 3-day delivery. She may have said all that just so that she could get something from her. And then at the end, all that quote unquote influence that she's been putting upon her and impressing upon her and kind of subconsciously is what they're envisioning is happening in this glorious fashion that she had said was going to happen. And in the end, Mother Mary is just going to do what she's going to do. We don't know what she did at the end.
Yeah.
All we know is that there is a beautiful red dress that is probably going to be sent to Mother Mary, probably what she wanted. Because what is the first thing she says that she doesn't want the dress to be? She doesn't want it to be red. But what is all her dreams made of? What is everything that is in her thought process? Everything is red, which means she has a fixation of red. Maybe she really does want a red dress. Subconsciously, she says, I don't want a red dress. It can't be red. It can't, but it becomes red.
Which is also where she had her incident. She was wearing a red dress.
Again.
Yeah. So it's...
This is all hearsay from a situation where somebody is still getting something at the end of the whole thing. So again, I'm not trying to lean more heavily, but you're giving me more opportunity to think that it's more so that than it was my first sense of logic.
Which that's an even a more interesting one to kind of move through about grief and trauma bonding and choosing to heal and making the difficult choice to do, you know, to move on, which is something we see Sam do, mm-hmm. where she gets to the point where Mother Mary is no longer talking to Sam, has switched to a new stylist, and Sam has gone to see her in Hyde Park. And she says it, she's standing in the crowd and she's staring up. Literally, and she goes, you didn't even see me. I was staring up at you and you're on the stage and you were glorious. And then Sam starts talking about that she was clenching her jaw so tight that she broke her wisdom tooth in half and realized that it wasn't intense love that she was feeling. It was something else. And then it turns into spawning this entire ghost, which isn't really a ghost, but this whole personification of not only grief, but anger and resentment and betrayal as a red entity, which I thought, which mind you, the trailers kind of made you seem like this was going to get scarier a lot faster and it was going to be scary. And coming from the resident wuss, this was not scary. And it wasn't really macabre or haunting either. It carried a little, it carried melodrama, it carried drama, but it didn't feel like I was being haunted as desperately as Anne Hathaway was being haunted versus Sam, Michaela being haunted, who the stoic firm, like, nope, no thank you, that's not what I want, I'm done, I moved it. And we have that flashback of the entity leaving and how Michaela talks about how beautiful it was to see it go. And the next day I woke up and I was
fine. To burn all your Taylor Swift posters and all your Taylor Swift CDs and figure out you're your own person.
Yeah, it was something to behold. And in juxtaposition, when the entity comes, assuming this is the same entity, comes for Anne Hathaway, the way in which it was introduced was very, very interesting. Like, to me, because again, I was like, okay, this feels kind of like, where are we going? Shouldn't it be spookier? Like, it didn't feel to the level of some of the sequences in The Green Knight, where it was like spooky, question mark spooky. This was just kind of like, okay, this is happening. Okay, that's weird. And then it moved on. Like, there wasn't anything else that seemed to make it extra scary. And then it became this weighted blanket that Anne Hathaway was constantly fighting in her mind. And mind you, the resolution of this film ends up you seeing that entity again and how they use it. And the question of, do we heal when we finally get the chance to air everything out? Or is it when we finally realize that we needed each other at one point, but we no longer need each other? Like, where does that grief, the intersection of grief and healing, truly reach an end?
We come to the point to where you realize ignorance is bliss and complicity equals ease of life, so to speak. Like, ultimately, that's what we get. I mean, if I'm looking at that same train of thought, yes, from the perspective of where you're coming from, yes, you could look at it as, you know, the recognition of the trauma bonding, the being able to process through, and then the ability to move past it and use it for good without needing to still be attached to the person, truly speaks to the real process of how people overcome that type of grief and that type of stress and trauma. But then again, I mean, I'm just saying the movie spoke for itself. I'm really struggling now. I don't think I'm more so like divided right down the middle equally. I'm thinking I'm more leaning on, I'm thinking I'm back. I'm thinking I'm leaning on the second one.
Yeah, I mean, well, you could be like the people that were behind us during the film, which were like, this was too wordy. Like, why were they talking so much? Which part of me was like, wow.
Like, if you didn't want to see a movie that had words, go watch a black and white, you know,
Artist, you can watch The Artist from Home. I still love The Artist. That was a
they
great
have
one
silent
too.
Films that you can go ahead and
they
watch.
Do,
there's a
Buster
whole
Keaton.
Like, there's a whole consortium somewhere that has a ton of those. So
yeah, and this so this film overall, I think it was really well acted.
I will admit it definitely was a surprise for me in a lot of the performances. I mean, there's really only two main performers in the whole movie.
Truly,
you know, you have Anne Hathaway and Michaela Cole. But I have to say, like, Michaela Cole, like, was the standout performer in this entire movie. I'm not going to deny the work that Anne Hathaway put in for everything she did in this movie as far as dance, singing.
She put out an album. It's available on Apple.
Woman has abs in this movie.
Yes.
You know, and that is definitely a hard thing to come by. But if we're going to call a spade, Michaela Cole.
With a jawline to kill all jawlines.
Acted in circles. And with every right inflection, every correct head movement. I honestly would have probably loved this movie even more if it was just Michaela Cole playing opposite herself in the other role. Like if it was just Michaela Cole playing both roles. It was just really great. It was a really great performance. And I do have to say, surprisingly, I'm probably going to be on the lookout for the next big feature she's got coming out. So again, I've always adored Anne Hathaway as a performer. I feel like she's super underrated. I feel like she's always just been Mia Thermopolis for a lot of people, unfortunately. But for me, she has always been the young teenager from the movie called Havoc, which was one of the first times I had seen her. And oh my God, that was an insane movie. Havoc is essentially, I believe it's like from 2007. I don't even remember. She essentially plays like a young affluent teenage girl. Her and her best friend, I think, end up getting involved with like this Mexican gang. Mm-hmm. And it creates a lot of problems because she's from like the rich side of town and they're not. And it's probably one of the most vulnerable moments I had seen in her young career from her as an actress. Of course, moving on, she did a bunch of other things here and there. Interstellar, Batman, was it The Dark Knight Rises? Mm-hmm. Obviously, not Princess Diaries.
Yeah.
No, I was going to say Devil Wears Prada.
Yes, Ella Enchanted.
But there was a lot of...
No, so she was Mia Thermopolis before Havoc.
No, I know. Oh, there's no way she could have done anything within Havoc if she was under 18. I'm just saying right now.
I know, but she did Princess Diaries in 2001 and Havoc was 2005.
Yeah. No, I know. That's what I'm saying. But and I saw Princess Diaries like maybe in passing, but it wasn't really a big deal for me. But yeah, Havoc is one of those movies that's like, ooh. And then she did some really like incredible movies later on in her career that I actually really low-key appreciated. The Intern with Robert De Niro.
I love that.
Such a
movie.
Good movie. Colossal. Phenomenal movie. If you haven't seen it, such a great unique twist to that one.
She's in Ocean's 8.
She's in Ocean's 8. True.
One of my favorite is Becoming Jane, which she plays Jane Austen opposite James McAvoy, which is really fun.
Yeah. But either way, like, again, she's a great performer. Obviously, the Les Mis movie, she did great there. There's a lot that you can say about her as her career is very vast and it's very diverse. So this is just another opportunity for her to stretch her muscles and be something outside of what everyone else has expected her to be. Was this her best performance? Probably not. Was this probably the most demanding performance of her? Probably. I don't really know. And I'm not going to be the one to ask because that was already a whole thing with another interviewer who asked her about her like whole workout regimen during The Dark Knight Rises. I don't know if you ever heard of that.
Mm-mm.
She was on some show. It was a news show, but she was being interviewed for The Dark Knight Rises. And he was just like, you know, oh, I bet you must have had to work out to really fit into that cat outfit, the Catwoman outfit. Like, what did you have to do? Like, what was your workout routine like? Like, man, you look really great. And it was just, he was just really like pushing it. And she had to be like, you know, are you like, do you want to try on the Catwoman outfit? Is that what you're saying? Do you need tips? Cause I'll lend it to you if you want. Like, she had to like really kind of push off of that whole thing. But I'm pretty sure this was one of the more demanding things she's had to do in a while, especially with singing, dancing, and then a lot of the physical performance, aspects of this role. but I don't think it outshined Michaela Cole's role in this one.
Yeah, Michaela Cole, not just with jawline, but present. It was
ticks stop of talking her head. About the woman's jawline.
It was so insanely chiseled and gorgeous, and I was like, oh my God.
She's more than a jawline.
She's more than a jawline. It was the tick of her head, the eye movement, the way she carried herself and everything. There was this roiling anger just below the surface at all times, but it was balanced with indifference and longing to be the person she had been when her and Mother Mary had first started out and she was styling her. But where she is now, where she's like, nope, nope. It was the like, it was the get behind me, Satan mode, like modality without being like, get behind me. It's like not as a joke. Uh-huh. And it was, I think one of my favorite sequences was Mother Mary's up in the top of the, they're in the barn, which is this her workshop, Michaela's workshop, Sam's workshop. And, Michaela is talking about, you know, Mother Mary's like, I don't want to wear a halo. I've been wearing a halo all this time. And Michaela's like, well, I could have made a better for you. She's like, they hurt. She's like, yeah, I could make them better. I could make you one right now. And she's gone down the stairs and she turns to look at, she just like, Michaela just turns and it's this very brief moment, but the costuming, the light, the music choice, it literally gives this moment where Anne Hathaway embodies all of this glorious energy.
So that outfit was her first outfit.
Was her first outfit. And then the explaining of it, and also Sam pulling out the Vogue magazine where there was like this entire display of all of the outfits that she had built and created in tandem with Mother Mary. However, in the interview, she never acknowledged Sam at all. And she's like, yeah, I just wanted to tell the story. I wanted to look like Joan of Arc. And then you get Michaela giving this very, it's not just chilly. It's so like, you robbed me of my story by taking not only what I gave you within partnership for your artistry, for our artistry, but you completely, you just said, I wanted to look like Joan of Arc. And she's like, I wanted this. And the reason this is there on the outfit is because of this. And the reason this is over here is because this is what happened to me when I took my first communion. Like, it's so well monologued in this spot.
Yeah. Clearly just stating Michaela Cole did a really great
job. Yes. 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 I mean, it was so striking because in comparison in Wakanda Forever, she plays one of the Dora Milaje who ends up becoming part of the Midnight Angels, which is this whole big thing in Marvel, which I don't even know if we're ever going to see. And I'm like, I need more. More for me, please. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I would say, do you have any highlights? But we've kind of hit the highlights.
Yeah, I mean, there's not really much else to kind of go through again.
Costume was brilliant.
Yes, as you stated, the costuming was brilliant. It looked really great. Did you even look up who the costumer was?
No, I didn't look up the costume designer, which makes me feel like a terrible person. But remember,
this is your show.
We're trapped in the closet. This one.
Yeah, I think other than that, the set design of the stages were really great. I thought even some of the music compositions that they chose to do with Anne Hathaway pretty unique, and I really thought it was interesting the fact that it was Anne Hathaway who created those songs. So
yeah. It was Charlie XCX and Jack Antonoff were people that were composing, and then Anne Hathaway was helping to write as well. And then, like I stated earlier in the episode, she actually released like 24 minutes. It's an album titled Mother Mary's Greatest Hits, which is really interesting because I haven't seen a score come out for this movie.
I'm pretty sure there's one.
If you can find it before me, that's not a playlist somebody cobbled together, I would be more than happy to listen to it. But that's been something really interesting to listen to as late of late as well. Yeah, the words got stuck. Okay.
Okay. Don't gotta get mad at me.
No, it's just now you make me feel bad about my couch in here.
You really need a new couch.
But there's no money in the budget. I tried and I asked, and you know, they're just like, you're an intern. You can do that. You can fix it if you want to.
Ugh. So how do you wrap these things up anyway? So
usually I just abruptly press end and run away. Sometimes crying. Most of the time not. I've been really good about that recently. Because this is like the first time really that you've been in one of these intentionally. Because I think the first time I tried this, you yelled at me. But Spencer was there too. Wait, no, the first one we did, we were stuck on your weird gold guns and a Merry Christmas thing. Yeah.
Okay.
That wasn't my choice. I didn't plan any of that. But anyway, you guys, thank you for listening to me ramble about Mother Mary from A24 and David Lowery. While it's still in theaters, if you are interested in it, please go ahead and take a look. Help support not only your independent film studios as A24, but also the opportunity to support your local theaters, because let's be honest, everything's going to streaming recently. And as much as I like, you know, watching movies from the couch, whether in my super cool guy office or at home, we talk about community. We talked about community today. And really, when it comes down to it, film.
I just
needs
sent you the
community.
Score, by the way.
Oh, cool. Thanks, Daniel Hart. Good job. I'm going to have, I don't know where you found that, but thanks. I tried. I couldn't find it.
I know where to look up stuff because I make the notes.
I don't know what you're talking about. But really, we were talking about community today and the best way to continue to support film and the artists therein and all the creators and makers is to go to your local theater and support the art that they create. This is being one of them, and help continue the community that is film. This has been the Film Philosophers, and please be kind and rewind. And we can't meet. Wait, blah, blah, blah. See, I can't even do it. You looked at me. We can't wait to meet with you next time. So I'm gonna push the button before Eddie makes a sudden jump at the door. Okay, bye.